Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for April 27th, 2011. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, as promised, I have a rant on the innovation tax, exactly what that means. Just some thoughts that have been bouncing around my brain about probably themes that Tim Wu gets into in a book I'm going to read shortly, The Master Switch, really kind of consolidation and concentration of power in the instance of what Wu's talking about. He talks about monopoly specifically. Here I'm just talking about dominant incumbents and spaces and how that often can present certain forms of friction and challenges to innovators that I think are disproportionate and unfair. I also have a new hacker word of the week. First, though, I really hate to do this given my track record lately with delivery of episodes, the unintended hiatus, the accidental hiatus, if you will, that I took just the other week. I don't think I'm going to be able to get a newscast out this Sunday. It's Brew Day on Saturday. I have an out-of-town guest, actually someone who's been on this podcast before, Chris Miller of the Secret Layer podcast and from Python Import podcast. Hosting him for the weekend, the activities that normally surround a brew day, let alone one where we have extra people in the mix, and a very busy work schedule this week have really kind of put a crunch on any time I might have been able to dedicate towards preparation for Sunday's newscast, unfortunately. So I think I'll just go ahead and take a miss on it, as much as I haven't been able to get a newscast out apparently very reliably over the past month and a half, but I will have a feature cast on Wednesday. Actually, I'm looking forward to putting Chris to work while he's here, not just on the beer, but actually on mic in studio here to talk about a subject that actually follows up on a couple of other pieces that I've done in the last handful of months, going all the way back to my rant on Nowhere to Go, some of my frustrations with my career, and the last interim chapter I did on personal growth. We're going to talk about, I think, from a retrospective standpoint, more of our experiences with job and career changes. And I think that's going to be a bit more kind of positive, a little more contemplative, and I think that'll make a nice complement to those two other features if you want to go back between now and then into the archives and listen to those. So you'll just miss out on Sunday. I might try to pull it out, but no promises. It's very unlikely. I was hoping to get a little bit of writing done for the newscast last night, or Monday night rather, and maybe Thursday, but it's just not looking like that's going to be possible. So odds are really kind of stacked against getting that show out. The hacker word of the week comes from the Jargon File, maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Flash Crowd. Larry Niven's 1973 science fiction short story, Flash Crowd, predicted that one consequence of cheap teleportation would be huge crowds materializing almost instantly at the sites of interesting news stories. 20 years later, the term passed into common use on the internet to describe exponential spikes in website or server usage when one passes a certain threshold of popular interest. What this does to the server may also be called slashdot effect. It has been pointed out that the effect was anticipated years earlier in Alfred Bester's 1956 The Stars, My Destination. Quite a few people recently linked to a Harvard Business Review piece that tries to highlight the risks inherent in an intellectual monopoly-maximizing regime. The author, James Allworth, exposes a trend with which copywriters are already well familiar. Hollywood has almost always had an adversarial relationship with technology. He quotes Jack Valenti from the charged rhetoric around the earliest days of the VCR. You know the line relating home taping to the Boston Strangler. This fear goes back to piano rolls and even printing presses, as successive waves of those became cheaper and more accessible. Technology is an easy focus, though, for a concern that is more diffuse, something that I've been thinking about even before that piece came out. Innovation invariably disrupts markets, usually driven by technology, but really as a consequence of the ensuing changes in behavior. Technology merely enables those new behaviors, but not all new devices and mechanisms catch on in ways that upset the apple cart. It's kind of tricky to predict which is going to be the next big breakout killer app. What Allworth really describes in the article is one aspect of well-funded market incumbents being able to extrude a pseudopod outside of the established sphere in which they dominate into emerging markets based on those new behaviors to try to still disruptions that might weaken their otherwise predictable bottom line from the existing space in which they dwell. The manifestation of this reach in this instance is a regulatory capture. The deep pockets of Hollywood allow it to buy influence that way outstrips what innovators can afford and even steps on the influence that should stem from constituents who may be fans and cheerleaders of those new technologies and offerings based on their firsthand experiences that better match their expectations, such as free access to music, device shifting, and other novel applications. There's a certain sense of almost entitlement, I think, that flows from these market incumbents, a sense that's fairly insidious. Dominant position in some sector often induces an expectation that the market will always remain as statically as it is for the very top of the top. When you put it that bluntly, it's of course rather silly. Without exception, every company that enjoys a substantial market share was at one time themselves an innovator breaking into a new market. Some such players, like Hollywood and Microsoft, have been ensconced for so long that we forget their earliest history as disruptive innovators. In the case of Hollywood, they originally were in conflict with Edison and his regime of extensive and controlling patenting practices, including the earliest forms of film and audio recording. Game theory informs a lot of this perception and the consequent behavior. I learned about this particular aspect of game theory that I have in mind by way of a simple heuristic that I was taught as part of learning the game of cribbage. That's a card game that's very common here in the U.S., especially in the Northeast, in the New England region. After the cards are dealt, you have to select a couple of cards to give up. You get six, four of them form your hand, and those two that you give up form part of the current dealer's extra or bonus hand, and of course the role of dealer swaps between players. Neither you nor your opponent know what the other is going to give up, so you really only have your relative scores to guide your choice. When you're losing, you have nothing to lose and everything to gain, so your best play is to take larger risks. When you're winning, risk plays into your opponent's favor, giving them a chance to catch up with you. The aversion to risky gambles is pretty apparent in many of the actions of market leaders. Take Hollywood again as an example, one that has been chewed over quite a bit recently. Cory Doctorow linked to a fascinating interview with Francis Ford Coppola recently. Here's a filmmaker who is very well regarded and undoubtedly immensely successful. As an artist, he clearly wants to take chances, to continue to try new things, as experimentation is key to learning and keeping his art lively. It is the studios that reject his desire to attempt novel projects. They want what they know, at least based on past performance, will profit. It doesn't matter that Coppola has a core audience that will come to his films regardless. In order to justify the budgets with which movie studios deal, they cannot tolerate less than spectacular takes at the box office. The hoot is that even the films they deem safer are just as risky in their own way. Audiences often tire of remakes and Me Too efforts and vote with their wallets. I suspect that studio execs overemphasize the game theory-inspired rhetoric. A poorly performing title clearly doesn't wipe out their coffers. None of this makes it any easier, however, to justify creative risks that often takes the equivalent in more artistic pursuits to what innovators have to do in market-oriented parallels. Where the value that innovators bring is more or less self-evident, lawmakers have often stepped in and enacted compulsory licenses. This is an after-the-fact and an explicit acknowledgement of the value in a new invention. A royalty rate to incumbents is often set at a level that is deemed to not overburden new entrants, but acknowledges that at least some of their efforts are based on what has come before, sometimes very directly. Examples of this include more modern examples, because this practice actually goes back to the Enlightenment, if not earlier, includes the lack of performance royalty for radio play of songs, and the fixed rate that cable TV originally paid to include terrestrial broadcast content in their bundled packages. Rationally, such cap revenues are money that incumbents wouldn't have realized if new players hadn't entered the space using novel technologies and approaches. The ultimatum game, with which you might be familiar, another bit of interesting sociological research, perhaps illustrates why receivers of money from compulsory licenses are rarely happy. The game is an experiment in decision-making between two parties. One gets to decide how to divvy up, say, $10, some set amount, between the two. The other can veto the deal if they think it isn't fair. In strictest terms, the veto holder shouldn't ever exercise that power that they're granted in the game. Any amount they get is money that they wouldn't get otherwise. It's all gain. When the experiment is run with real people, however, the result is that deals that deviate too far from a 50-50 split get rejected. That finding highlights how a sense of fairness, even if it contravenes the simple bottom line, can completely override rational decision-making. I think there is more to it than this simplest form, this bare exercise, but that the notion of what incumbents think is fair does end up factoring into their calculus rather heavily. The inventor doesn't just passively receive revenue. They work, sometimes quite hard. Worse, there isn't anything preventing incumbents from also entering these new markets that are created, effectively double-dipping their own offering and any fees they can collect from access to their assets and resources. In this latter case, I'm thinking of the ill-fated wholesale provisions for telcos here in the U.S. My own decision to finally give up on a competitive DSL provider was strongly motivated by how hobbled that competitive company was in comparison to Verizon, the local incumbent. I had to give up benefits that Verizon simply doesn't offer, like Unix shell access on the ISP servers, a static IP address, and other admittedly techie benefits, but benefits nonetheless once it differentiated the competitive local exchange carrier from the incumbent. All of this I gave up because of the sort of passive-aggressive games that the incumbent played, because they had those legislatively mandated rates, those wholesale rates, that they had to offer access to their lines. But they also had their own offering in the space. They couldn't compete on price, so they basically gamed the system every which way from Sunday to make me such a miserable customer of their competitor that, again, it led to the conclusion I described. And that's the nut. More often than not, small innovators have to pay an innovation tax in some form directly to existing players. Sometimes this is in the form of licensing, whether it's compulsory, what I just explained, or even negotiated in the market on a case-by-case basis. Arriving at rates through the market or an industry body severely limits the rate at which new competitors can enter the space. It gives too much control to the incumbents. For another example, Netflix's library for online streaming has swelled and shrunk over time, I think, as a consequence of how the studios perceive its innovation. Initially, they were reluctant, mostly likely due to their overinflated sensitivity to piracy, that offering this up through a new technological medium would expose them more than traditional forms with which they were more familiar. For a very brief period, the popularity of Netflix and its early traction with its new online streaming offering seemed to overcome that a bit, allowing the innovator here to broker deals, perhaps even playing incumbents off each other a little, on the premises that streaming availability might be an advantage in existing spaces, so that producers had to think seriously about whether their titles should be absent if their competitors were present. As consolidation continued with the NBC-Comcast merger that has started, that all has started to change. NBC has a toe in the water of streaming. Some of their titles have been pulled back out of Netflix's catalog. The problem with this is that the competitive offering is far from that. The mindset of the incumbents when they do try to match innovators is informed by what Siva Vaidyanathan's idea expressed of if value, then right. If there's a value in streaming, then the incumbents see it as a right of action, and then that they can extract some monies from that, some revenue, either in the form of profit or rent. It's comparable to copyright and the ability that confers to strongly exclude others as a mechanism for driving that value. Now, not only do innovators need to raise the necessary and legitimate capital to get going, but they have to pay off those who didn't have the foresight to pursue new opportunities in the first place. When those existing players are able to ensconce their original value as a right, they can even simply deny innovators through legislative powers around that right access altogether, leaving them to die on the vine or giving them disproportionate leverage in negotiation. A right in some form, whether that is a negotiated rate or a compulsory license, along with other considerations, may encourage this long-term extraction of rents as opposed to that outright vetoing. If an incumbent does come up with a competitor to an innovator, I suspect it may open them up to antitrust complaints. We might find some form of relief where that more explicit leverage of their original position to their advantage can be characterized as anti-competitive to the detriment of the newly formed competitive space. There are certainly other forms of taxation on innovators. In spaces with incumbents or where incumbents have influence, rather than the ability to extract straight-up licensing fees. The practice of defensive patenting can also raise the bar to entry for new players and lead to disproportionate value going to larger existing companies, even when they aren't doing much of anything to build on and really push the subject matter that's embodied in those very patents. Ideally, the playing field needs to be closer to level to encourage fresh thought and experimentation. Large incumbents should have to compete on the same merits as innovators. There are a couple of factors that inform efforts to unfairly tip the scales. Especially in the US, we're seeing the rise of an urge to extreme profit. It isn't enough to make a tidy profit and maintain the same revenues year after year. Many companies seem to see a failure to grow as being tantamount to complete failure. Coupled with a drive to expand at all costs is an overblown fear of the competition. These two drivers are probably two sides of the same coin, as flat growth is likely seen as a sign that competitors, in a zero-sum fashion, are growing at the expense of an incumbent's own share in the market. Where this really becomes a problem, as I've touched on, is when large incumbents showing these two traits enter into new spaces to compete with innovators. Success in one realm, say content produced for broadcasts, shouldn't really convey any large overt rights in other spaces previously unimagined, such as online streaming or novel ways of time format and place shifting video. As if the disproportionate sway in the market isn't enough, incumbents often are able to exert lobbying power well beyond that of new competitors. Such influence undoubtedly follows a very similar form as market power spilling into new segments. An established company has more experience at working inside the Beltway and often has cultivated relationships that can more easily be expanded. New endeavors have to try to catch up from a standing start. They don't have the benefit of those pre-existing relationships or experience working with congressional representatives on the Hill. They also often have far fewer cash reserves to spare because they're concentrating their assets and their resources on their core efforts to bring some new invention, some new offering to light. From this perspective, I think it becomes a lot easier to see why Lawrence Lessig, very well respected for the work that he's done on copyright year after year, the many books he's published on the subject, why he ultimately left that space to focus on the undue influence of money on politics. Removing or reducing the chance of regulatory capture at least puts the emphasis back on the market itself, where at least a lucky innovator can possibly catch a swell of support from customers hungry for a break from more of the same that is often on offer from complacent incumbents. I think novelty can account for much, like why Facebook and Twitter rose so fast from such humble beginnings despite the dominant position of, say, a player in the space such as Google. I am encouraged to see some larger innovators are starting to get fed up with this state of affairs. Amazon and even Google have been in the news recently about pending cloud music services. The bit of the coverage that has really jumped out to me is that rather than negotiate licenses, Amazon at least seems to be building on a particular case. Cablevision was an innovator that won out in a legal fight against the studios to be able to offer DVR-like capabilities, but supported remotely rather than embedded in a set-top box as is the norm. Amazon may be banking that they can make similar equivalency arguments about the ability of a customer to stream copies of their own music from online storage, freeing them from having to have any particular device with them. The whole situation is very similar to the story of MP3.com back in the day, if you pause to think about it for a minute, except for the fact that bandwidth and storage are now much cheaper, so much so that Amazon is hedging their bets by storing distinct copies of the same identical media for each user. MP3 got in trouble because they were trying to consolidate and dedupe those copies, and I think that's what caused them to ultimately lose to the incumbents. Before Amazon and Google, Apple does deserve some credit for pushing for the right to innovate. They arguably refused to be bullied on license rates for iTunes, though a circumstance at least in the beginning was on their side. Initially, the market for iPod and iTunes may have been too small to be a threat to big content. Perhaps part of the problem is that they've now, since then, wised up. Tomorrow's heavy hitter could be today's pipsqueak, and there's no way of telling. A safer strategy, that being the case for the content industry, then may be to throttle all up-and-comers regardless, rather than try to get the cows back into the barn after the door has been left open. Seeing our current circumstance in that light should give everyone pause, whether you're a champion of laissez-faire economics or believe that a market more closely scrutinized is more fair. Innovation shouldn't be an opportunity for some incumbent to extract rents. We also shouldn't have to rely on larger companies that choose to act more like genuine innovators to push the right to experiment and create back to a more fair middle ground. The idea of fostering new endeavors crops up every so often when pundits and legislators talk about trying to stimulate the economy, especially since the large downturn of a couple of years back. If they're serious about this rhetoric, I think they need to look far more closely at what holds back startups with truly novel ideas beyond pure financial measures like stimulus checks and tax cuts. After all, creating a safer environment for invention and creation is valuable in and of itself, regardless of whether the economy at a given time is weak or strong. These are just some of my thoughts around this idea of an innovation tax, some friction that may arise from a variety of circumstances that I've touched on to hold back entrepreneurial efforts. And I will admit that it is long on problem and short on solution. I am hesitant to suggest that we regulate in any particular way, but I think we do need to frame and think about this in terms of fairness and, as I said, that leveling of opportunities. If you have some thoughts to add to this discussion, if you disagree with me wholeheartedly, or you agree and more so have some constructive input that you would like to share, as always, you can send it all to feedback@thecommandline.net, where I'll be happy to share it with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoy the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. As I said in the intro, there almost certainly is not going to be a newscast on Sunday, so I probably won't talk to you next until Wednesday, so until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.